The Engineering Commons is a podcast dedicated to the challenges that engineers encounter, regardless of which industry or field they work in on a regular basis. These can be overarching topics that affect us over our entire careers, or stories of everyday frustrations and how to deal with them. This is the show for March 21st, 2013, and it's about sparking one's interest in engineering. So, Chris, what have you been up to lately? Oh, crap. I forgot. I need a new co-host for the Engineering Commons. Where am I going to find one at this hour?
Hey, Jeff. I'd be interested in co-hosting the podcast with you.
Really? You would?
Yeah, I'd be interested as well.
Do you guys mind if I get in on this too?
Wow, this is great. Three potential co-hosts. Oh my, this could be a difficult choice. Voice number one, what is your name and what do you do?
My name's Adam. I'm a civil engineer. I work for a transportation department in the upper Midwest. I went to school at South Dakota State for civil engineering with both a bachelor's and a master's.
Wow, that's terrific. Terrific. Well, Adam, welcome. Voice number two, what is your name and what do you do?
Jeff, my name is Brian Petchel. I am an electrical engineer. I've been in industry for about 8 years. I've spent most of it doing hardware design in the aerospace industry. I've also done a little bit with optics and power control.
Wonderful. Well, Brian, thank you so much for chiming in there. Voice number three, what is your name and what do you do?
Hi, Jeff. My name's Carmen. I'm an electrical engineer as well. I work in the analog semiconductor business as an applications engineer. I deal a lot with switching regulators. I went to school up in Rochester, New York at RIT, and I've been in industry about a year and a half now.
Well, fantastic. Well, I'm so happy that we've got some potential co-hosts here. I was noticing that on Twitter the other day that there was a group that's runs under the heading of Big Beacon. They've got a manifesto about what they think engineering education should be like, and they're talking about I know that the authors or the people who run that program are writing a book that they expect to publish this year. But recently on Twitter, they've been asking what got people into engineering. And so I thought that would be, since we've got several new voices here, that that might be a good way to get introduced. So we can talk today about what sparked your interest in engineering. So why don't we start with you, Adam? How did you become an engineer?
Well, thinking back, I can't actually remember the first time I knew that I was going to go to school for engineering and become an engineer. My question was more, what type of engineering? I grew up.
So you were never, you always knew you wanted to be an engineer?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. I grew up around engineering. My dad's an engineer and was brought on site occasionally back in the day. And I grew up around it and I knew that's what I wanted to do.
Okay. And how did you decide on civil?
I had an internship with the city where I lived. And I initially went to school for mechanical. About 3 months into that internship, I decided I want to be able to go outside. This is what I want to do. And I fell in love with traffic engineering. And it's really hard to describe why, but I love going to work every morning.
Okay. Well, terrific. Well, so as a mechanical engineer, I know virtually nothing about traffic engineering. What kind of calculations does one make? What's the fascination with traffic engineering?
There's a lot of things to it. I get to do something different every day. I can go outside and see what I've done, and I can make changes. Traffic engineering would include things like signal timings and design, freeway operations and signing. And some of these things can be changed very, very quickly, and you can see the impact, and you can see how you're improving people's lives daily. And that's just, it's a nice feeling being able to see how you've improved somebody's commute and made it shorter or safer.
Right. So what's a great day for you? I mean, when you go out and you go to an intersection and you've made some change, what is it that you see that you go, boy, that was good. I made a difference. Is it just the traffic flows more smoothly? Is that the major?
For the most part, and just shortening people's commutes, people not having to sit and wait, or just clearly people being able to navigate the intersection safer, not having to take gaps they shouldn't.
Okay. And I suppose in the same way that in school I might have, you know, studied thermodynamics or fluid flow that you've studied theory about traffic.
Yeah, and actually the theories are very, very similar, although very aggregated.
Okay.
Traffic changes day to day, so the numbers are very approximate. There's an art to coming up with the numbers, but it's very, very similar to fluid dynamics, which I also took plenty of.
Okay. Right. Well, you've got to worry about all the drain system, right? Stormwater and all that stuff?
That's definitely part of civil engineering. That's kind of my secondary focus. Not that I do a whole lot of that nowadays. But yeah, surface flow drainage, which is actually a lot more complicated than pipe flow. Pipe flow is far, far easier to deal with.
Okay. Okay. And so how do civil engineers react to the typical thing I hear is MEs going that civil engineers build targets and MEs, you know, blow them up, that kind of thing. Do they take that with a grain of salt, they laugh at it, or they get really irritated by that kind of talk?
I think it depends a little who you talk to.
Okay.
I when I hear it, it means job security.
Okay. Well, speaking of that, the job security, at least it looks like from the employment numbers I see, it looks like civil engineering is a pretty safe bet these days. That there seems to be a lot of need to rebuild the infrastructure in this country.
It's on the rise. The American Society of Civil Engineers puts together a yearly report card. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, the United States is not doing well. I haven't looked at this year's, but typically most grades are failing.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how much technology advances, people still want to get from point A to point B. We still have to ship all those things that the electrical and mechanical engineers design, get them to stores.
Right, right. And is the role of the civil engineer changing as time goes along? I guess I'm thinking in terms of we think of civil engineers as building roads and bridges, but we've been building roads and bridges for, you know, I'm going to say 100 years, maybe longer than that. I mean, certainly the Romans were building bridges, so – that form of bridge even longer. But I'm wondering, with just modern technology and information, is civil engineering, like a lot of other engineering disciplines, becoming driven as much by software as it is by, physics?
I think the software gives us the opportunity to do more with less. And then there's that expectation. It may be a little different in consulting. Most of my work, working for a public organization, is just keeping the system running. Mm-hmm. Just making sure that people can get to work in the morning versus large scale improvement projects, which we would typically hire out to a consultant.
Yeah.
It may be a little more parallel in some fields, but mostly the technology is just driving that we need to do more with less.
Right. Right. Now you're fairly young to the job market. I mean, to engineering. Is engineering as a career? Is it what you expected it to be? Is you're a little under 2 years in engineering, right?
About 8 months now.
8 months, so under a year. So is it what you expected?
For the most part, yes. I had some exposure during summer internships, and I had some great bosses that let me do things, let me start engineering, even as a freshman and sophomore, within reason. So I really felt I knew what I was getting into when I finally graduated.
Right.
There are certain things that they told you was going to happen in school at the time I knew wasn't really going to happen, or I've since learned, you know, I don't do those sorts of things regularly. Frankly, most of what I spend my time doing is communicating, writing, talking to people, answering emails.
Right.
And then just solving small little problems here and there.
Right. Well, on previous shows, Chris and I have talked a lot about, you know, networking and communication is a large part of what engineers do, despite the fact that you know, we don't get trained much for that in school. It's all, can you crunch the numbers?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I spend more of my day talking to people than actually crunching numbers.
Terrific. All right. Well, let me turn now to Brian. What sparked your interest in engineering? How did you get involved in the engineering field?
Well, you may not remember the movie Real Genius, but I felt the need to see a 6-megawatt laser fire. actually, I do love that movie, and it was very important in my youth.
Okay.
I was always interested in technical things, but I wasn't destined to go into engineering. I actually went to school for journalism for the first 2 years.
Really?
Yeah. And was insanely bored. And
why were you bored? Was journalism not, what was it, the writing part, or was it just the theory wasn't interesting to you?
Well, what's really interesting is I thought journalism would be writing. But then you find out that journalism is more about information gathering and then filling out the form, you know, putting your story in AP style. And, the murder victim is always, or sorry, the murderer is always an alleged murderer. You know, you always have the, you always have the murderer's age, you know, immediately after. And then for the rest of the story, the murderer's listed by his last name. And, that wasn't extremely interesting to me. I started to get a little bit technical. I kind of tested the waters in computer science. And then I wandered into the electrical engineering wing of the building and just asked somebody, could somebody please tell me what engineering is? And right. 3 hours into the conversation with a guy who would ultimately be one of my mentors, I was hooked. You know, I wanted to do embedded systems more than anything in life. And luckily,
I take it that was his background, embedded systems.
Yeah. I think, let's see, how would you, he founded a very successful business in inspection systems, which I think at the time, if I remember correctly, weren't entirely PC based. So I think they were largely embedded, if I remember correctly.
Okay. Well, I'm just impressed. The guy sat down and somebody walks in off the street and he's willing to spend 3 hours sharing his story and does it so, with so much passion that you're hooked on the profession.
Absolutely. And that actually gets to where I went to school. I went to a relatively small school called the University of St. Thomas. It's one of many small liberal arts colleges in the Twin Cities. You kind of have the big dog in terms of population in town, which is the University of Minnesota. I forget. I bet that's somewhere between 20 and 50,000 people. And then you've got a couple, you know, 5 to 10,000 student schools inside of the city. So I had a lot more freedom, and it isn't a major research institution. And as we've talked about in the past, it's taught by professors that spent the majority of their career in industry. Or at least that's the way it was when I was there. I'm now realizing it's 8 years. But yeah, so no, that was not uncommon for somebody like this professor or virtually any of the other professors to do. But yeah, so that's why I got into it.
And so, obviously, your move to get into embedded systems, did you ever look at any other engineering discipline?
You know, looking back on it, I didn't.
Okay.
I already had a background in software. I don't know that I would have been a good fit in mechanical. And I'm a physics geek. And it, for whatever reason, the field side of electrical engineering was very interesting to me as well. So it just kind of worked out. It's very serendipitous.
Right. And so now that you've been in engineering 7 or 8 years, are you happy with what the career has brought you? Is it what you expected?
It drives my wife nuts.
Okay.
She, for the first couple of years that we were married, she was very annoyed that I would come home happy every day. And it was very much like high school football games where you leave everything on the field. You just kind of get home and collapse.
Right.
I've absolutely loved my profession to the point that it doesn't really stop. I'm kind of a full-time engineering geek. I come home and sit and read, you know, IEEE Spectrum or, you know, Wired or anything I can get my hands on that will feed me more engineering content.
Well, that at least sounds, when you said that, I thought you were going to say IEEE specs, and I was going to be really impressed if you spent your evenings reading the specs as opposed to the
Spectrum magazine. have you ever broken open 802.11?
No,
I have actually. Briefly, and then I closed it and huddled in the corner for a while.
Yes.
Okay, and that third voice, let's talk to you for a little bit. Carmen, what sparked your interest in engineering? How did you get involved in the field?
Well, I always enjoyed technical stuff growing up as a kid, watching my dad fix things around the house. And some of my favorite scenes in Star Wars were watching Han Solo fix the Millennium Falcon okay. in the heat of battle. So that sparked my interest in technical things. But engineering specifically, was in 10th grade when I was taking a robotics class of all things. I had a really great teacher who taught me the basics and kind of ignited that spark in me.
So tell me, what about it did you enjoy so much?
Just building things with my hands, pretty much. Seeing the robot come together and lift the brick and carry it away and watching circuits come to life as I played with them. Really having that tangible feeling of holding something in my hand, saying, this is mine, this is what I built.
Right. So for you, it was a very the hands-on part was very important.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love just sitting down with a big pile of components, whether it was Legos or, you know, circuit pieces, and having something at the end of class saying, this works now and it didn't before.
Okay. Well, one of the things, I'm just curious, one of the things I have, in fact, I blogged about one time was that whether we sort of trick young students into the engineering field by, we have these things, we invite them to the first robotics stuff, and we have Lego builds and egg drops, and we have all these hands-on things. And we get them inspired about engineering, and then we send them off to college where they spend hours and hours in the classroom figuring calculus problems and have very little hands-on activities. Now, I know the engineering colleges are working to have more hands-on projects, but when you were going through school, did you feel at all like you had sort of been tricked into it, or you were unhappy because you didn't have more hands-on time?
No, not really. Okay. Actually, that summer right after 10th grade, one of the local community colleges had some extra grant money, and they put on 3 engineering courses over the course of a summer for high school students. Mm-hmm. So I took another robotics class, one on mechanical engineering where we did model rockets, and then the final one was an engineering science class, and they taught us all sorts of engineering physics. So I got to see the calculation side right from the beginning, and it didn't scare me off, so it actually hooked me more.
Okay.
Well, terrific. And then, some of my classes in school, I could say I was a little bored with if we didn't have any application or a lab associated with it. But for the most part, whether it was math, theory, or actually building something, I was happy.
Okay. And did you look at any other engineering fields?
I toyed with the idea of going into aerospace, but something about working with circuits just made me happier and more interested.
Well, it's certainly a little easier to wire up a circuit on the kitchen table than it is to build a rocket on the kitchen table. So.
Definitely.
Cool. And now I know that you've sort of your area of specialization is in analog circuits. How did Yes. you come to specialize in that area, and why did you make that choice?
Well, in school, I started doing research pretty early on with one of the professors who was in robotics, and I found I didn't get a lot of work done because I didn't care so much for writing the software, but rather what all the little ICs on the robot actually did. Mm-hmm. So that was my first clue. And then I went out on my first co-op, and I was working with one of the engineers there who did a whole lot of circuit design. He was pretty much their go-to design guy. And just some of the little tricks he would do in circuits, and I was only a second year at the time, so I didn't even know what a transistor was, barely. I didn't understand what he was doing fully, but just watching him do it, I was like, that's what I want to do.
Okay. And how much of that knowledge that he covered during your internship did you eventually get in the classroom? Did you eventually get to the point where you were covering that, or was he using a lot of tricks that are sort of just tricks of the trade?
Yeah, I think there were a lot of tricks of the trade, but I did get into a lot of pretty deep analog design classes at school, and it definitely helped me out at other internships and here now that I got a full-time job.
Terrific. Terrific. And so you're happy with your choice of getting into engineering?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Okay. And like Adam, you haven't been in the field super long.
No, I think I just hit my year and a half anniversary, or I will shortly.
Okay. And but so far, approximately what you expected?
Give or take, yeah. There's a lot more people involved in the IC design process than I ever realized. Even in my classes, it just seemed like, you know, here's some specs, go design a circuit, some other guy tests it, and it's out the door. But it's a whole process that it just seems to loop back in on itself sometimes, but it's right. Pretty cool.
Right. Well, neat. Yeah. Well, okay. Well, so I guess as long as we're sharing what sparked interest, I'll give you just a little story of what got my interest. Sort of like Brian, I thought that I wanted to be a writer. I really didn't think engineering was going to be the way I went, even though my father was an engineer. But as I got, you know, got to be my junior year, senior year in high school, I had several good friends that were enrolling, in engineering at, Purdue, which is where I ended up going. And, it's like, well, I know that you kind of struggle as a writer and you make pretty okay money as an engineer. I guess I'll go. And really it was nothing more, you know, deep than that. I really hadn't thought much about it. But fortunately, once I got there and I got to the classes, other than struggling with the math, I was really interested in the theory, you know, the fluid flow and the thermodynamics and all that stuff. I kind of liked that stuff. And so it sort of grew on me. It wasn't like I really knew that engineering was what I wanted to do, but once I got into it, it was pretty cool. I enjoyed it. So I'm happy I made that move. So let me sort of, as opposed to talking with each of you one at a time, I'll throw this open to the group and we can kind of discuss this thing. So what do you think will keep you in engineering? Are there things that you're looking forward to in the future? Are there technical challenges you want to solve? Are you looking forward to the money? Do you want to move up into management? What are you looking forward to in your engineering careers?
My first management job. I'll be honest.
That's it. You're ready to be an engineering manager or just a manager, period.
Just a manager, period. No, I'm kidding. I remember a period after graduation, probably about a year and a half into my career, where I was agonizing over that. I felt like the careers bifurcated at some point. You had to choose management and business, or you had to go get a PhD. And I think it took me another 6 years to learn how to relax. So I'm very willing to admit that I have no plan at this point.
Okay. So was there something about management that you didn't like, or you didn't want to do, or you just enjoyed what you were doing so much you didn't want to leave it?
Well, so unlike you, I came up in a family that was primarily business oriented.
Okay.
A lot of my extended family, with one notable exception, is lawyers, executives, that kind of stuff. And so it's something, you know, due to the dinner table conversation, that I'm very comfortable with. It wasn't alien to me, and I could really respect what that career path is. And so, you know, there's always something buried in the back of your mind. I'm sure somebody who wants to be an artist but grows up in a house of engineers, you know, as much as they love art, is probably feeling, oh, man, I should really go get a practical degree. So as much as engineering is, I guess, ultimately very practical, I still have this nagging in the back of my head, like, you know, this is all just a run-up to, you know, you taking the jeans off and putting on a suit.
I don't think I'll ever take my jeans off.
Cold, dead hands.
Yes, yes. I'm still very new to the industry, but as of right now, I have no plans to move up into management.
Right. And so, well, I'm just curious. So what makes you think you don't want to go into management?
I just love the technical side too much. Just sitting on my bench with a, you know, pile of equipment and going to town and finding bugs and chips and hoping to find workarounds for those bugs and spinning boards. I can't see myself growing tired of that.
Okay. So here's the scenario that I predict happens is that you're going, all of you, or I'm going to guess probably Brian, if you've been in the industry 7 or 8 years, you're probably, if not at 30, about getting there. But that's going to about the age where people start making this shift where they pretty much have to make this decision. Am I moving into management or am I staying to a technical path the rest of my career? And so they come and they say, hey, you want to be a manager? And it's a, you know, it's a 15% bump or sometimes, you know, a bigger bump in salary. And you go, you know, I got a new house or I got another house. I got a kid. I got something going on. And all of a sudden that becomes a tough decision. Am I going into management where you get some prestige? You get the nicer parking space. You get to go to the executive meetings, or am I going to stay and be an engineer because I love the technical stuff? So I guess that's not really a question. I'm just more a speech than anything else. But it happens mid-career, and I don't think there's anything wrong with making either decision. I would love to come back and have this discussion 10 years from now and see how each of your careers, what paths those careers ended up taking.
I'll put it in my calendar.
I just got very depressed all of a sudden.
You know, you say that. One thing I really like about my field is a lot of our managers are still technical professionals. They still get to go out on site and they still look at things and they solve the harder problems, the ones that, because they have 20, 30 years experience, the newer engineers just don't have the experience to do it. And it's our management is almost exclusively engineers that still maintain active licensure. They still practice. Not as much as they used to, but they still go out and do the work.
So, how about you other guys, Brian and Adam, or Brian and Carmen, are your managers primarily engineers or are they more managers that have been, maybe have just a technical background?
Carmen, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. My boss is definitely still very technical. He maybe doesn't spend as much time on the bench as I do, but he's kind of maybe moved from more of the hands-on to the theory. He does a lot of architecture design for our chips, trying to define the next generation and coming up with some high-level simulations that the designers can then take and turn into transistor circuits. So that definitely has some appeal too, and maybe I want to move down that path too one day.
Okay.
So I'm in a position of changing. So in the past year, I've had two different kinds of managers. At the small company that I'm at right now, my manager is very, very technical. You know, if I had to classify his job, it's probably 70-30. I'm just guessing. And, you know, he's brilliant at what he does, or what we both mm-hmm. do. But, you know, having just come from, you know, a very large company, you know, the manager – as soon as you put on your manager hat, the technical stuff pretty much ends. You are in status meetings, you know, constantly. It seems like you just become a communications conduit.
And that's been, at least the jobs that I've worked, especially the larger organizations, that's been my experience, that I always had bosses that had an engineering degree, but there always seemed to be so much time spent on, you know, putting out fires and crisis management and communication and policy making, that there seemed to be little time for them to get involved very deeply into the technical issues.
Yeah, I would agree.
And I'm sure that's different with every company has its own culture. So I'm sure that's different depending on where you go.
It's obvious to say that the bigger the bureaucracy, the more bureaucratic work there is. Actually, I'd be interested to hear what Adam has to say on that, because I would just assume that the government would be very bureaucratic, but if your bosses are that involved, you know, maybe it's not. Maybe it's relatively, I hate to say the word, flat.
Oh, there's definite bureaucracy, and a lot of it. It's just the organization is very technically oriented, and we're making a change away from that. Well, we may be making a change away from that. There's been some recent changes at the top. But even just one or two levels down, essentially our board of directors, they're mostly engineers. I've talked to them, and they go out and they solve technical issues. Maybe not frequently, but they're dealing with pushing the money around, which is a certain part of what every engineer in our organization does. We've got to manage the budget.
Is there anything, since you're all fairly young in the engineering profession and seem fairly happy with it, is there anything about the engineering profession that bothers you? Is there any problems you foresee, any storm clouds on the horizon, or does it all look pretty good to you from where you sit?
No big game changers that I can see so far. I mean, obviously every job has some parts you don't like, but can't really see any showstoppers right now.
I was thinking a lot about that earlier. You know, I think the big bullet point is going to be how I don't want to use the word foreign. Everything is seen in the lens of foreign engineers coming and taking or jobs being outsourced to them. And I guess that sounds way too nationalistic, you know, us versus them. I'd like to see it more as just more brains on more interest in problems. But, you know, you do kind of worry about how I don't want to say easily, but, you know, the herd certainly seems to be for large corporations to reduce their U.S. footprint and increase it abroad. And you kind of wonder what the pipeline's going to look like for engineers in the future.
Yeah, it's certainly, we certainly move in that direction in a couple of ways. One is the software keeps opening up and making it easier for people to design things and make calculations. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can go out and, you know, if you get your hands on one of the big CAD packages, SolidWorks or Pro-E or, you know, whatever your flavor of the month is, that's a lot of power. And you can do stress analysis on that stuff and flow analysis. And sure, you need an engineering background helps you understand what those numbers mean. But somebody who's bright and has some access to that could easily do a lot of the work that engineers do, especially in fields unlike civil engineering, where everything has to be signed by a professional engineer. For a great deal of, you know, the other engineering fields, at least what I know in mechanical and electrical, you don't need a PE to do that kind of work. So I certainly think there's an issue where, even aside from international competition in the engineering field, it's just generally becoming easier for people to do things without needing an engineering degree.
You know, I see a little bit of that, even people coming in or calling in, sending an email. They've done a little bit of research, but they've decided that they're an expert, or they feel that they're an expert without really having that background in that theory. And a lot of these decisions are a lot more complicated than you can pick up in 20 minutes.
Right. Oh, definitely. when I first started, I was just a couple months in on the job, and I made a comment at one of the meetings after an engineer mentioned he had to find some bugs and fix them and what have you. I said, you know, can I get a beer if I help out? And he just kind of laughed. And I didn't mean it to be, you know, snarky or anything, but he must have interpreted that way. And he just said, we'll see how you make the decisions when, you know, there's $20 million order on the line and you're the one who has to find the problem with the chip and make it start or make it switch properly. And, you know, reading a couple books and putting something on the internet is a lot different.
So he didn't take your comment as offering to help. He thought you were saying you could do better.
Yeah, yeah.
And which did you mean?
I did not mean that I could do better. I must have just conveyed my tone wrong there.
Okay.
And that kind of was a rude awakening for me, because I realized, yeah, I don't know what I would do in that situation. And I kind of just kept my head down then and learned what I could from him. And, you know, it's been working out so far.
Right. Right.
I also see another storm cloud that, you know, it may be the industry that I'm coming from. I'm kind of concerned, and I'm sure there's some wonderful papers that have been written and are to be written about complexity, that a lot of the things, you know, a lot of the systems integration that we're starting to do as a society, it seems like traditional engineering practices aren't scaling. I saw this really great DARPA chart that showed how the cost of aircraft Geez, I wish I could remember. Was it, it looked like a linear plot against, or maybe even a quadratic plot against time, where basically the complexity in time associated with each advancement, each incremental change is pushing the cost and, cycle time through the roof.
Right.
And you look at a lot of big software projects, and, you know, I'm thinking of some of Microsoft's projects, and I've seen some email, or it's not email, some articles that have come out of, Microsoft, where it's just the software projects have gotten so big. How do you even manage it? How do you keep that many moving parts in an organization moving towards, you know, a design goal? How do you even design something where you don't have kind of the benevolent dictator at the top who's saying, you know, this is what I consider good?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that sort of comes up when people are deciding how big a division should be. You know, how many people do you allow to be in a division before you say, this, we've got to start a new shop or start a new plant? And some places, I think I was reading the other day that, I can't remember the initials, but the Gore company that makes fabric stuff, their policy is 150 people. You get more than 150 people in a group, it's time to open up a new shop, a new plant. Just because of that thing, you can only get, at least socially networking, you can only get so big before it start, you know, things start to fall through the cracks. So I think you're absolutely right, Brian, that complexity is a real issue, that we start piling thing upon thing upon thing, and it all sounds good and it's all wonderful when it goes right. But when something goes wrong, then it all starts to tumble down, and no one wants to spend the time and think about what's going to happen when it comes tumbling down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember reading something similar like that in one of Jim Williams, who's a pretty famous applications engineer from Linear Tech. In one of the books he edited, The Art and Science of Analog Circuit Design, either the first or the second one, one of the writers had said, you know, all these new CAD programs come out for designing ICs, and they're supposed to revolutionize design time and cut it in half. And he said, what ends up happening is, yeah, you cut the design in half, but then everyone says, oh, we have all this extra time, let's add 5-6 more features, and then the time blows out again. So time of development really kind of stays the same or increases.
Right. Now, one of the things I remember Chris talking about was the fact that there's a real emphasis to start pushing, you know, basically a design platform, that instead of, you know, here you pick the tools and you do this, that everything's become so automated. We, you know, we've got the FPGAs, and we've got, you know, ASIC development, and everybody has their own tools for doing that. And that the vendors want to push you into their, you know, obviously get you to buy their tool set. But once you've done that, you're pretty much committed to that. And so whatever they're doing down at the, you know, the transistor level, whatever switches they're making, whatever, you know, combinations and connections they're making, you know, you let that happen. You're sort of distancing yourself from that. And I guess that's good. It's sort of like writing in C instead of writing in assembly code. There is that sort of distance. Do you find that being a problem?
Well, I guess seeing as I'm on the chip vendor side, it's kind of good for me.
Okay.
keeps me employed. But yeah, no, I see that even in the power industry, you'll see if you start looking at all the product catalogs, you know, you try to integrate more and more power rails onto one chip, and it becomes very application specific, maybe even down to the vendor sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is so-and-so's chip, and it's not going to work in somebody else's system.
Right.
So right. There's even some of that going on at the transistor level.
Okay. Okay. What about you, Adam? How much push is there to use particular software systems in your industry, or are you free to pick what you want?
Well, we have organizational edicts on a lot of that. We're totally sold into one design software, and I haven't spent a lot of time in our design group yet. But as I see it, it's one of those expectations that we can do more because we don't have to do earthwork balancing calculations by hand. So we can do twice as much, right? And the designs get more and more complex. Driving any major urban area, and we've got interchanges where there's flyover ramps, mixing, and it looks like a bowl of spaghetti sometimes. 50 years right. ago, we never would have thought about doing that. But now it's the norm.
Right. Right. Well,
and it looks pretty as you fly in.
Yeah, and there's something to be said also about changing the focus on what's valuable. You know, when we first started with transistors, they were so valuable that we, you know, electronics designs were done to minimize the number of transistors that you needed. But now it's transistors are so freely available. We, you know, who cares how many transistors you build a chip that has, you know, thousands and thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of transistors doing nothing at all, because it allows you to do other things very flexibly. And the same thing with memory. When we had computer memory and early on, it was so expensive, you needed to be doing assembly code to make sure that each little bit of memory was being used efficiently. And your clock speed was so low, you needed to make sure that you're getting as much done with every clock cycle as you could. And now we've got so much, you know, memory so cheap and hard drive space is so cheap and clock speed is so fast, at least relative to what it was 10 or 20 years ago, that seems immaterial. It's wasteful now for engineers to be spending their time worrying about, you know, which register to shift some value into. So I think there's something to be said about we do have to separate ourselves, but as Brian originally said, that does make us more continually more dependent upon the complexity of this infrastructure that we rely on.
Well, I've seen in some ways, and I'm purely hypothesizing, that a lot of the lower level complexity, and I think we think of microchips or processors, MCUs, and various other digital components, those things tend to scale very... I am way out of my pay grade here. If there's any ASIC designers or if there's anyone doing VLSI design, they're going to hate me.
That's what comments are for. They can find exactly. The show notes and add their comments and tell us where we were wrong. we want to learn.
But I was going to say, it seems to me that transistors, as you said, on a microprocessor, it's very homogeneous. It's homogeneous. It's a lot of the parts are identical, and the interfaces between them, you know, the interface of one is very similar. The interface of one block, it's made out of the same thing that the other block is made out of. I think when things get really goofy and really complex is when you move across multiple domains. So you've sensor interfaces, and then you take that mechanical sensor interface, make it electrical, and then you want to put that on a network, and you want to sync those up to a larger network of systems. And I guess as soon as you run across multiple domains, and you no longer have somebody, you no longer have a group of people that are all working with the same core competency, mm-hmm. things just fall apart, or they can. You know, you'll have somebody who's, you know, a analog sensor designer having to interface and divvy up hypothetical resources on a design with a digital designer, and, you know, who's pulling their specifications from, you know, what software needs in order to run the system. I've seen those be more problematic, and I think I've seen some anecdotal evidence that other places, other industries are seeing the same thing, that making a chip really complex or making a microprocessor very complex scales very well, but we have a tough time talking to each other.
Yeah, it's at the interfaces that the problem seems to always occur. You know, you're, mm-hmm. in your case, if you're, you know, you're talking across a, you know, a sensor network or something that's running at a different speed, and, you know, you make some adjustments to make sure that the two systems can talk to each other. And you think you've got it all, but what, you know, what always catches you is the little glitch that no one thought about. The, you know, when somebody powered up at 3 a.m. on an off cycle, on an off night, because, you know, something else had gone wrong. And those are the things that, you know, the things that you think about are not the things that get you. It's the things that you never think about that are the ones that catch you and really cost you in the end.
And that's what keeps me up at night. There's only so much validation you can do on a chip before it has to be released to production, and you always wonder, did I catch every last bug, and did I optimize the design just so? And gives me shivers.
Yeah, there's a book called The Black Swan that I've gone through a couple times, and it talks about sort of these unexpected things that happen, and they make the author tells the story of the casinos in Las Vegas, and that they lose their money not because what happens on in the casino, because they've thought about all that stuff. They know what the odds are, and they know, you know, how much a customer has to play in order to lose enough money to make it worth their while. They know all that stuff. Where they lose their money is that somebody sneaks in, you know, one of their employees sneaks in and makes off with the money, or through social engineering gets a password, and they lose money that way. And it's never the things they think about that is sort of their bread and butter. It's the things that they can't expect cause them so much difficulty.
Yeah, we never know. Well, in some cases we do, but we never know what our chips are going to get hooked up to and how they're going to react. And, you know, if that sends something back down the power line and hits our regulator and breaks some, you know, feature we didn't even think to test, or well, not think to test, but, you know, think to test in that manner.
Right. Right.
Could have some very long nights after that.
Yeah. So, Adam, how about that in civil engineering? How often do you, you know, open up a intersection and the traffic is completely different than what you expected, or the use of the road is completely different than you expected?
Well, I don't know that happens so much. And part of it is certain things happen very quickly, but a lot of things happen very slowly.
Okay.
Several of the projects I'm working with right now are not even going to be bid until 2020.
Wow, that's pretty far out.
I think that we have a couple going out this year, but the life cycle of a project is huge. And you have a lot of time to look at these things, and things develop. There's a certain degree of our users are the general public. Everybody is out there. So you really have no expectation of anything, of how they're going to use it. You just have to make it as clear as possible, as uniform as possible. And at the end of the day, if you can do that, it'll probably work out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm going to get off topic here just a bit, since there's a big intersection near us that is just getting wrapped up, and it's been under construction for like 4 or 5 months, which is like 2 or 3 months longer than it was supposed to take, because they started digging up the road and they discovered that the, you know, I don't know whether it was pipes or it was telephone lines or electrical, whatever, was buried in the wrong place, or whatever they had marked on their prints. I'm guessing that this must happen because somebody, you know, digs a ditch, buries the line, they know it's in the wrong place, and they go, ah, it's close enough, pave over it, and life moves on. Or could that never happen? Am I just guessing wrong?
It certainly could happen.
Okay.
I think a lot of it comes from the age of a lot of the infrastructure.
Right.
A lot of roads have been in place for 50 years, 100 years. It depends on where you are. And the data just wasn't as good back then. So right. It wasn't as accurate. And some of those things, we still have a lot of data like this. Oh, that person knows where that is. So-and-so buried that, they know where it is.
Right.
Well, if they did that 70 years ago, that person's not there anymore.
Right.
So you're relying on whatever notes they did from memory before they left. That's a bad system. We're moving away from that. But there's a certain degree of that out there. And there's always the unknown unknowns. Risk management is a huge part of what we do on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
These things happen. You figure out a solution in the end. And just hopefully you get it done on time, on scope, and on budget. Does that happen all the time? No.
Right.
Right. We all know better.
Does that happen ever?
Rarely. Occasionally. We spend a lot of time and effort working on trying to make sure we deliver everything on time, on scope, and on budget.
What tends to be the biggest bogey in civil engineering? Is it just the weather, underscoping projects?
Politics. And that may be actual politics, legislature, governor, people like that, making decisions, deciding scope, changing scope, them expecting things to deliver quickly. Or it's a city who decides, while you're doing this, why don't you add a lane? And the time to do that was 5 years ago.
Right.
When we could have done the designs. Now you deal with the flack of the newspaper and there's nothing you can do. Or you end up coming up with a solution, which may or may not work.
Yeah, I term that that effect creeping featureism. You show somebody an idea for a device or a system, and as soon as you ask them ahead of time, what do you want? What do you need? And they have not a clue. And as soon as you show them the prototype or you get it on a machine onto the production floor, they go, I just needed A, B, and C, but I could now use D, E, and F, and it shouldn't cost too much. And can you have that for the same time and on the same budget?
I also think there's a lot of sticker shock. People don't expect a lane to cost $500,000 a mile, $1 million a mile. And especially even these cities, they don't realize how much interstate costs. And so, we can do that. It should be easy. Well, it takes us 5 years to develop that plan. Plus, it's going to cost an additional X many millions of dollars. Sorry.
And how about the maintenance costs? I've always wondered about this. We keep building miles and miles of interstate and new road. And there seems to be, I never hear any political discussion of how much it's going to cost to maintain all these miles of highway we've developed.
That's a good question. I think we just figure out a way to do it. Better technology, we can do things better, and we just know we have to plow the roads.
Okay.
So we get them plowed. They are crumbling. Well, we find a way to do it if we can. Otherwise, unfortunately, they crumble.
Cool. Okay. So as long as I'm picking on civil engineering tonight, let me just ask. Okay. So what is it with roads? It seems to me the roads, at least here in the Midwest, where it freezes and thaws and freezes and thaws and we break up the asphalt, it seems like every 3 or 4 years they're going back and repaving, re-asphalting over the same road. What is it about asphalt that we, after this many years down the road, after, hundreds of years of using asphalt, we can't figure out how to make an asphalt that will survive the winter?
That's a really complex issue. It's actually more about the water.
Okay.
And, I don't know a lot about the geology in the area you are in, but even where I am, we have a very widely varying state, and depending on where you are, the subsurface water conditions are what drive that. And with asphalt particularly, that's an understood issue, that it has a short life. Concrete lasts longer, a lot more expensive, and it takes more time to put down. You can be driving on asphalt very shortly after it's placed.
Right.
So we put up with asphalt. And actually a lot of it's more the trucks. We're running bigger trucks, running more of them than, I don't remember the exact percentages, but a single overweight truck does far more damage than a legal weight truck. And legislatures keep saying, oh yeah, you can run heavier trucks. You can run longer trucks. And the roads that were built 50 years ago were designed for what was legal then.
Right. And I know that the states want the traffic going through, so they get part of the revenues of the trucks stopping and filling up gas and delivering mm-hmm. stuff to their states. And I do know that truck companies, especially if they're running heavy loads, sometimes have to run several states south or north of where they want to go just to make sure, well, if they're doing it legally, to make sure they're traveling the right interstates. From the civil, I guess, from the politician's point of view, we want more business, we want more jobs, we want more revenue, we want more economy, so make it heavier. They don't care because they don't have to fix the roads. But from the civil engineering side, do you have a sense of how that decision gets made, where you set the limit?
Well, that limit is – it's a law. We really can weigh in, and that's about it. And the trucking lobbies in most states are very, very strong, typically stronger than the state agencies who have to deal with it.
Right.
So it's the solution is we just have to deal with it, figure out a solution. And that means the roads are a little more beat up. Well, and when it comes down to it, more trucks is good, more gas tax, it's more funding.
Right.
It's about the closest thing to profit that we can equate. Because there's no sales.
Right.
The legislature collects taxes, they give us money, they say, here's how much you have, do what you need to do. Oh, and by the way, you should probably do these things.
Right.
And we make it work.
Neat. Well, I had some discussions with Dave Gevers, who was we had a guest on the show previously about patents. He had designed his own aircraft, but he had done work previously designing trailers for the interstate trailers. And there's some real fascinating calculations. He was taking me through it one time, and how you decide how many wheels you have on the trailer, and the distribution of the wheels, and where the load has to be placed relative to the wheels to maximize the load you can carry, and the size of the beams in the trailer to take the load. There's some real fascinating calculations that go on in those trailers that for years I'd pass them on the interstate and think nothing about it. And since talking with Dave about it, I can't go by one of those without sort of taking a quick look at how big the beams are and making a quick calculation in my head as to where the load's centered, that kind of thing. So I know it's a we think about it as being simple, but that's really a complex little engineering computation that has to be made deciding how to design those and to what Adam does to decide then, how much load the various roads can handle when you've got those trucks running over them.
Yeah, and it's very good that those trailer manufacturers are taking that into account. We've got to get it. The more they can spread that out, the easier it is for us to get that on the pavements and down into the ground.
Right. Do you? Not that I expect you have all these numbers off the top of your head, but so you have any idea how much traffic on the interstate is truck traffic?
Well, it widely varies.
Okay.
A couple of the interstates where I am, 25%.
Okay. I mean, around here, I'm in the central Indiana area, and Indianapolis has a hub where we've got I-69 and I-65 and I-70 and I-74 all coming into the same loop around 465 around the city. And boy, at times it seems like 70% of the traffic is trucks running through here. So I just wondered.
Yeah. Average would generally be 10%. If I don't have data, that's where I'd start.
Okay.
But interstates can be a little higher.
Okay. Okay. Well, I appreciate that. We're sort of coming up on maybe time to start bringing this episode to an end. Now, when we did the introduction, I said that we had three choices here for the next co-host. But in reality, I think that if it's all right with you guys, we'll proceed with four co-hosts. We'll rotate here when we interview a guest. But you guys okay with having four co-hosts for this show?
I'm on board.
Absolutely.
Sounds good to me.
Okay. Well, terrific. We'll do that. In the past, I've said that you can get a hold of me through Engineering Revision is my blog site, even though I haven't posted since a year ago, April, when we started this podcast. I should put something up there. And I'm also, you can find me on Twitter as at Sheltonier. Any of you have a blog site or Twitter handle you want to promote?
I'm kind of in the same boat you are. I have a blog, but I don't get to post nearly as much as I'd like. The blog is Fake EE Quips, and I also tweet under the same handle if anyone wants to come find me.
Okay.
No blog for me, but I am accessible at B2 Theory on Twitter, which is just B as in Brian and 2. So
the numeral 2.
The numeral 2.
And what about you, Adam? Any presence at this point?
Nothing really at this point, but I'll get together an email for anybody who wants to contact me, and I'll get that in the show notes.
Okay. Well, and that's fine. If anybody in the listening audience wants to get a hold of us, you can always leave a comment in the show notes, and we'll try to respond to that. Okay. So anything, any closing remarks, any thoughts you've got? Has the experience here, is your first episode of the Engineering Commons been okay?
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Okay.
Yeah, it's been fun talking to you guys. Looking forward to the next time I can join you.
It's been a blast. I'm pretty sure I enraged all VLSI designers.
Well, then we've done something right.
Let's make that a goal from now on. Enrage one subgroup of engineering each episode.
Exactly.
Very good. Okay. Well, we'll bring this one to an end. And I thank you, gentlemen, so much for being on, and look forward to our next episode.
All right. See you guys later.
See ya.
The Engineering Commons is produced by Analog Life, LLC, and Engineering Revision. Theme music by Paul Stevenson. For more info, visit theengineeringcommons.com.